In association with Newsarama, welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. We finally continue with our Word Balloon After Dark conversation with Matt Fraction and Ed Brubaker. And with apologies to Dan Juergens, the real masters of the Tangent Universe are Brubaker and Fraction. The idea was to come on and talk about their collaborations on X-Men, maybe their solo books, like for Brubaker, Captain America, Daredevil, for Fraction, the Invincible Iron Man, Thor, Secret Invasion, etc. What followed was an incredibly random discussion where more names are dropped than Disco Stu uses trying to get into Studio 54. You are going to hear some comic book talk. We do get into a good discussion about Criminal, what's going on there for Brubaker, and also some plans Fraction has for Thor tying into the Secret Invasion. And we talk more about X-Men 500, their beginning of their collaboration on the Uncanny Run that starts with issue 500. But first, we start with our usual pop culture random talk, this time a little discussion about Superman.
Yeah, I always thought that's what they should have done when they killed Superman. Not that I was reading the Superman books at the time, because the only Superman books I've ever been able to read are either Superboy and the Legion or like the Jimmy Olsen or Lois Lane comics from like the 50s and 60s. But seeing that happen.
I think DC Silver Age stuff lately.
DC Silver Age. Actually, the old Adventure Comics Superman stories are pretty good sometimes. The Kurt Swan era.
Yep.
But there's nothing like Jimmy Olsen stories for me. Just, you know, those Jimmy Olsen and some of the Lois Lanes, like with the Lois Lane Black Like Me. And
classic.
She joins a motorcycle gang. And, you know, I love the really old ones, though. There's like a great one where she thinks that she's figured out who Superman is, and she thinks that Superman is Bruce Wayne.
Okay.
And so Bruce Wayne asks Lois Lane to marry him, and it's all a practical joke that him and Clark Kent are pulling on her for always trying to figure out who Superman is. So she's about to get married to Bruce Wayne, and they're having this huge wedding, you know, of course, because he's a multimillionaire, and all of her family is there. And he's like, "Oh, we're ready, Lois. We're just waiting for the best man." And then Superman shows up to be the best man, and comes flying in, and she realizes, you know, that she can't marry this guy because she thought she was about to marry Superman. And you know, that's the big joke.
So she had sex with somebody. She's totally had something different. It's a little.
I don't think they had sex. It was during
the Dick Sprang era. That led to the storyline. Bruce Wayne, a consensual rapist.
I remember that. Sure.
Yeah.
A horrifying exploration of the politics of the bedroom and when no really things know.
Did they burst?
Stunning work.
I only wanted you because I thought you were Superman.
Did they burst out laughing?
I thought you were Batman.
Did they do the thing where they're like, "Ha, silly Lois, ha, I would fool you."
Yeah, the last panel was actually them laughing at her as she's crying and her whole family is like embarrassed of her. And they're like, "Ha, ha, ha." They're like chuckling about it. And it's like the meanest comic of all time. But
as Lois puts the gun in her mouth.
Yeah.
Don't you want to?
I'll never marry Superman.
It's times like those that don't you want to go back in time and meet Walt Weisinger and go, "Seriously, man, what the hell? Like, why do you hate women?"
Read
the first 50 issues of the Fantastic Four sometime and just some of the ways that Reed talks to Sue.
That's true.
Oh, Sue, you're a woman, you wouldn't understand. Like, there's a lot of that.
It is kind of a bummer that the woman's power is to turn invisible.
Well, I remember there was one where Willie Lumpkin comes in with a stack of mail, and they're reading, and then a fan writes and says, "You know, I love the whole Fantastic Four except Sue. She sucks." And then Reed really admonishes the writer and says, "Don't you remember the time that Sue saved us from Dr. Doom, and really only she could do it with her powers?" And it really was this kind of like, "Hey, Sue's okay, and she's an equal member, and this is why she's important to the team." And I always thought that was kind of
interesting. She's actually the most powerful character on the whole team.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, across town, Mort Weisinger is lighting cigars. Hey, sweet tissue.
Yeah.
And then Bruce Wayne slaps Clark Kent on the back.
Sue could actually defeat any, like, Sue could defeat Dr. Doom. She could just create an air bubble inside of his armor that just explodes out.
Sure.
You know, like, she could, you know. All right.
Criminal. Nice going on the three issues, man. They were a lot of I won't say fun because of the subject matter, but I really did enjoy them. I thought they really fleshed out the more of the characters in this region or city or however you're really describing what I've called the criminal universe. And you laughed at me when I first said that, so
yeah,
I won't call it that anymore.
I had no idea what the fuck he was talking about.
I was lost.
Talking to me? Is he talking to you? What is he?
What three issues?
Criminal.
Criminal.
Yeah, I know. I got it eventually.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought I said Criminal. Okay.
Yeah,
it would have been embarrassing if I started answering the question. So I'm glad you got it.
Yes, those last three issues of Casanova were. I really felt.
Yeah, we already did.
We
that
did Casanova. We covered him before.
Oh, you covered Casanova before I even got here.
We already the last time we talked.
Yeah, last time Matt and I talked, we did a good thing at Casanova.
Talk.
Oh, okay. those were really, really hard. Like, I thought those would be really easy for some reason, and because I'm like, oh, I'll have 30 pages, and I'm like, yeah, but each one has to completely stand on its own, and it's been said over and over again that it's much easier to write a long story than a short story, but I really, after the second one, I was just like, oh, man, what am I going to do for this third one? Like, I had my whole plan was I was going to show some of the same moments from the first two stories from the girl's point of view and really do like the whole plan was I want to do a story from the point of view of the femme fatale,
okay,
where she's the sympathetic lead and you really get into her mind. And then the more I started sort of telling her story, the more I realized I had like a whole other plan for that one. That's why that one actually ends at a completely different place than the other ones. That one actually ends before the other stories begin. And that was kind of, that came as I was working on the third issue, where I realized, like, oh, okay, this one's going to actually end on an almost sort of, it's not upbeat, of course, because you know that she's already dead when you're reading her story.
Right.
She's died. She's been dead in the first issue, and you saw her get killed in the second. So I thought in the third you see her arrive back in the city, like, on the way to her fate, basically. But when that issue came out, I was like, our dog had just gotten injured, and I was really depressed because we have to keep our dog in like a little kennel in the dining room right now, and we're spending a lot of time with him and stuff. But he's really bummed that he can't run around, and so I picked up that issue at the store. I was waiting for my comps, and I was looking through it in the living room and looking over my dog, and I was just like, man, I'm depressed. And then I read my comic, and I'm like, man, I write depressing comics. So I was like, oh, man. So it's funny because, the next story, of course, I mean, noir is meant to be somewhat depressing.
Absolutely.
But the next story that I'm doing is completely different than all of everything that I've done in the book so far. And, I don't claim that it won't have some amount of depressingness in it, but it is much more of a sort of a, nothing is what it seems kind of noir story, because I've never done one of those, and I really wanted to do, one of those stories where every couple scenes, everything twists around, and you start to see things from a different angle, and, I really wanted to do something like that, so.
I thought for a long time you should do, like, your Fargo, Like, you should do some kind of, like a black comedy,
Yeah.
That's cool.
I think it's still mired in crime, but, like, Fargo, a little bit like Fargo, a little bit like Big Lebowski, almost. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Place for you to take,
this is
like,
closer to that than anything
like,
I've ever done. There's
a bumbling criminal,
Yeah. Well, this one is actually about, well, it's kind of funny because, Coward is about a guy who really isn't a coward but has a rep for being one. But mm-hmm. Bad Night, the next story, is actually about a guy who is literally a physical coward for a lot of good reasons, because, he's been beaten near to death in his life and never wants anything like that to happen again. And, he is literally kind of a cowardly character who also has questionable mental health issues. And so it's a much different character than anything I've ever written before. And yet at the same time, like, little bits and pieces of it are spun out of, what would be the worst thing that could ever happen to me. And then the story started spinning out of that, like, 5 years ago when I first started taking notes on the idea. And, but yeah, there is definitely a lot of black humor in this one, because I wanted to do a different kind of thing than I'd done in Criminal so far.
Do you ever see a time, Ed, when you might let some other writer write under Criminal and, like, present other writers and stuff? Not to say that I'm not enjoying your
story.
Like
that. I've let them work for 10 years to build up their career and start their own crime comic.
I've already put my request in to write the Frank Kafka Private Investigator backup series.
Oh yeah, I totally I actually.
There you go.
I have that notated, that if we ever end up closing a movie deal on any of that stuff, that the Frank Kafka stuff has to all be cut out. And I'm like, nobody can get Frank Kafka. Like, Frank Kafka is going to be my screwhead or whatever. But yeah, the next story is about the guy who draws the Frank Kafka strip. Actually, the Bad Night features Jacob, who we saw briefly in Lawless.
Yes.
Oh, wait,
the guy who helped
Tracy
make his fake ID.
You changed the title?
What?
Didn't that used to be Vanishing Point?
No, that's another story that he's going to star in eventually. That's his next story, assuming he survives this one.
Damn, I was hoping you were done with that title. I would totally start.
No, Vanishing Point. He mentions the Vanishing Points like in the narration. He actually talks about viewing the world. The next story is a lot about insomnia, which I'm kind of a insomniac, sort of part time. Most of the time, I'm an insomniac, but I've been collecting quotes about insomnia for a few years now, and I just, I wanted to do a story about that mostly took place at night, which is when insomniacs sort of, go insane. There's a great Leonard Cohen quote that we, opened the issue up with, actually, that says something about, the last refuge of an insomniac being the sense of superiority to the rest of the world. It's funny, it's like, recently my wife and I were just bored and flicking the channels around. We saw something on Showtime called a Boys and Girls Guide to Getting It On or something like that, which was like a bad indie film told as if it was an instructional film.
Okay.
But it was like, keep an eye out for the crack whores or keep an eye out for the coke whores. This girl is a coke whore. She will do anything to get more coke. It was totally bizarre, but there was one really true moment of it, which was at the end when they were all going home from staying up all night partying and the sun was coming up, and remember your sunglasses. When they're driving home, the narrator, you see these guys who've clearly been up all night partying and they're on, they're coming down off of drugs and they're seeing people sort of going out of their house on their way to work, and it just says, try not to hate the rest of the world as they go about their lives. And I just thought, that's such a true statement, because I can remember feeling that way, and when I'm up all night and out and about, when I go to the 24-hour supermarket at 4 in the morning, and then I'm coming home and I'm seeing people up and jogging at 4:30 or something, I'm just like, oh, God, get a life, man. And I realize, oh wait, that is his life.
Yeah. Well, we're at the fun part of the conversation, because I don't want to keep you boys too much longer. Any movies, any recent DVDs that we can recommend for action?
John, I know a little place in the American far west where Charlie Briggs chopped up the finest prairies of beef. And this is a lot of shit, you know that?
So one-man band, obviously.
French. I got nothing. I work at my Orson Welles for you all day.
God bless you, man.
I'm going to, I rented something recently that shocked me, because it was actually really enjoyable and exactly the kind of movie that so many people try to make and fail at making. You know, when you see those movies and you're like, oh, this is like cult film 101. But that movie, Wrist Cutters, was actually really surprisingly enjoyable. I will watch a dumb, sappy romantic comedy, but this one looked like it had a really interesting twist and a really interesting take, and it was actually really good. My wife even liked it, and she hates romantic comedies at all. And this one, it's about some sort of alternate reality where you go after you commit suicide, and everybody there is somebody who committed suicide, and they bear their scars. So if you shot yourself in the head, the back of your head would always be gone. But it's somehow really, really uplifting and really, really funny. And Tom Waits is in it as
that's,
you know,
cool.
I don't want to ruin it at all. It was shockingly good. And it stars that kid who was in Almost Famous, who you always wondered why he didn't end up becoming a huge movie star.
Patrick Fugit.
Nice, yeah. Fraction, attaboy.
That was really good.
I literally, yesterday was thinking about, didn't Patrick Fugit ever go on and do anything?
There was talk of him becoming the new Spider-Man if Tobey Maguire doesn't come back or something, but there's also been talk of the kid from Brick.
The kid from Third Rock in the Sun, right?
Yeah, that was good. He was good. Brick was good.
Brick was fantastic. Yeah, I'm a big fan of that, too. Dude, I have to thank you again, Brubaker, because the essay in the back of that last Criminal issue, Mitchum is a great actor, and you love his work in the 50s and 60s, and for some reason, outside of the Friends of Eddie Coyle, I always forget how good a lot of those 70s movies were, and I gotta see the Yakuza.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the guy who wrote that article, Michael Stradford, is a VP at Sony who I'm tentatively working on a project with that I can't talk about. But, yeah, he's a huge Criminal fan, and he buys a lot of Sean's art, actually, and I was out with him, and he said, I should write something for you about the Yakuza. He's like, that's one of my favorite Mitchum movies, and I was like, the Yakuza? Really? I'd never seen it, and so he actually sent me a copy of it, when he turned in the article, he actually sent a copy of the movie too.
How is it?
It's great. It really is kind of like the last great Mitchum movie where he feels like Mitchum in a way. So
okay.
Have you ever read a Baby, I Just Don't Care, his biography?
No.
It's good.
I'm aware of some of his interesting turns in the 50s and you know, the turns in life and stuff, and how he almost got blackballed for smoking pot, and he was busted, and, you know, had to go to, you know, went to jail for a while. And
He had a kid really young, too. He and his son actually played brothers in like, a movie that he directed where they're, like, bootleggers.
Oh, wow.
And his son actually plays his younger brother in the movie.
Thunder Road,
yeah. Because his son
he recorded the
commentary
song title.
Yeah, I think his son is only 17 years younger than him or something like that.
Wow. What'd you guys think of him as Marlo?
I'm not crazy about those, honestly.
This is an incredible story about him doing that movie, about doing Farewell, My Lovely, and the suit that he's wearing, apparently, like, the budget was low, and he apparently was the same size as Victor Mature.
Okay.
Oh, my God. So
they had him wearing an old, like, Victor Mature suit from some other movie.
Wow.
He kept complaining about having to wear a Victor Mature's farted-up suit. I'm wearing this old farted-up old suit, this Victor Mature farted-up suit. I just love the color.
That's great.
Yeah, I always thought the Britishness of the 70s Marlowes were kind of weird.
I mean, I like the idea of somebody remaking all the Marlowes with the same actor. Like, that would be kind of cool. And you know, but Robert Mitchum was just a bit too old at that point. And my uncle wrote Murder, My Sweet, which was the original adaption of it. And they couldn't call that Farewell, My Lovely, because the guy who was playing Marlowe in that he'd previously been like a song and dance guy, though, and
yeah,
was just starting to be taken seriously as an actor. And so if they had something with the word My Lovely in it, they were afraid everyone would think it was like a musical.
Sure.
And
wow.
So they changed the title to Murder, My Sweet.
Dude, that is so cool, because what was your uncle's name?
Oh, John Paxton.
That is so awesome, because honestly, I think Dick Powell is one of those, like, forgotten great noir actors. And was so great.
He was Chandler's favorite Marlowe, actually. Chandler said he liked Humphrey Bogart and thought Humphrey Bogart was like a really great guy and liked him as an actor, but that he felt like Dick Powell actually was more the way he had always envisioned Marlowe in his head, more sort of quick on his feet and more of a wisecracker, and, you know, just there's like a scene where he like yells at everybody and then shuts the door and then kind of dances down a hallway. Like, he always pictured Marlowe being more that way, I think.
Having a little more fun.
Yeah, and a little less New York.
Okay.
You know, I think that's the thing is that, you know, Humphrey Bogart was a real sort of East Coast kind of guy.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's the difference between, like, when they were making Barfly, you know, Bukowski really wanted Sean Penn instead of Mickey Rourke, because Mickey Rourke is like a New Yorker and Sean Penn is a Californian, and he, you know, there's a difference in the way people carry themselves, and it was only, like, you know, when Barbet Schroeder convinced him to give Mickey Rourke a chance that he even, like, assented to it. But Sean Penn and Dennis Hopper really wanted to make that, apparently.
Oh, that's cool.
I think it'd still be great to see Sean Penn play Bukowski.
Yeah. No, I agree.
You know, they would have that same sort of L.A. sort of, you know, lackadaisicalness to the way they talk.
No, I could see that. Now, unfortunately, the best thing I've seen lately is I bought the first two seasons of I Spy on DVD.
I haven't seen those since I was a little kid.
That's how I felt, man. And it was, they actually, some of them kind of hold up, and I had no idea Robert Culp wrote several episodes.
No, I didn't know that at all. That's so funny. A friend of mine loaned me Banachek recently.
I loved Banachek.
Yeah, I haven't actually watched an episode yet. I was looking at it, I was like, I didn't even know he did anything before the A-Team. I hadn't really thought about it.
Oh, yeah, you know, that was Levinson and Link, the Columbo guys.
Yeah.
I mean, so, yeah, that was actually, those guys were great. If there were any good writers of mysteries in the early 70s, it was Levinson and Link.
So. Yeah, yeah. I recently, the most interesting thing I've seen recently, actually, is I watched the entire making of disc for Zodiac, just to see the technical stuff behind that, because Bendis was explaining to me how I didn't realize that they'd done so much, like, in the computer on that. Like, I thought that they'd found some locations in San Francisco and then just gone in and did a little bit of touch-up to get rid of stuff that looked too new. San Francisco, and then they would have rolling blue screens behind the characters in their cars, and then they would add in, like, the entire, like, they'd be on the same corner that something took place, but they would build the location based on crime scene photos.
Wow.
So, yeah, I mean, there's whole scenes in that movie. Like, there's shots that they filmed, and then Fincher didn't like it, and so he'd bring the actors in and film it on a blue screen and then show the 3D guys the original shot that he made and have them completely recreated as a 3D shot just because he didn't like the camera timing of, like, a pan or something.
Jesus.
It's really, but apparently that's why he brings his movies in on time and under budget, is because he's doing so much with the 3D technology, rebuilding, you know.
As opposed to that sort of the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull crap where it's so cool. Oh. I mean, Fincher uses CG to be invisible, you know?
I didn't think about it at all. Like, while I was watching the movie, it didn't occur to me. And, you know, having lived in San Francisco, I just thought, wow, he found those places that really...
Clearly, the mid-80s flies over the Transamerica Tower as it's constructed. That is clearly a
that's cool.
But even that, I didn't think about too much. I'm like, oh, what a cool, like, you know, that shot where they're showing time pass for, like, the years that they're building that building, and you watch it constructed as the day goes on. Yeah. Like, that was amazing, and that was just a complete 3D animation shot. But you just don't even think about it.
Well, I assume then that Fraction, you didn't like Indiana Jones.
I had a weird, I was extraordinarily sentimental towards it, and that provided a grand amount of kindness. The further away I get to it, the easier it is for me to kind of get more vociferous in how much I disliked it. But I had a very sentimental fondness for it when I saw it, and I knew while I was watching it that it was garbage, and that it was kind of embarrassing, but was not didn't quite kind of get my bile up. You know what I mean?
Okay.
I felt sorry for it.
Would that just sound like a complete sap? I don't know how to, like, explain.
No,
I didn't like it.
I felt sorry for it, and I felt sorry for all of us for, like, wanting it to be good when
everybody looked old and tired. The script was ridiculous.
I'm glad to
see that the hedgehog from Caddyshack is still getting work.
Yeah.
one of my fondest childhood memories, my dad took me out of school to go see Raiders. Like, I was, like, the first time I ever played hooky.
That's
cool.
Wow.
I
was, like, with dad's permission, so, like, his dad's day off. He's like, you know what, we're here. Yeah, so it's something. I was sick, but I wasn't really sick. And you know what I mean? So, and I remember watching Raiders sitting next to my dad and, like, squeezing his hand when I got scared. And then my folks took me out of school again when Temple of Doom came out. And then my mom and I went to go see Last Crusade on opening night. So, like, part of the movies and my family and all that, like, there's a tremendous soft spot in my heart for those movies just because of my own familial history. And then to see a movie, like, about Indiana Jones and his son, and, like, I have a kid named Henry, and suddenly, you know what I mean? There's all this kind of, like, oh, my God, it's like every song on the radio is about me.
Oh, my God.
I mean, you know what I mean? So, like, I was having these kind of
I'm starting to have a panic attack right now.
Are you okay?
Matt has actually created the entire universe as a kid when he was watching Indiana Jones with his dad, and we're all just a construct in a Philip K. Dick world.
I felt that way, man.
Creation.
I suspect.
You know what I mean? But I was having this kind of unfair, like anytime you're like, oh, but the spider monkeys are okay, because it's about family. Like, no. The spider monkeys are crap.
I honestly, and I thought this when I was seeing it the first time in theaters, when Last Crusade came out, this is why I kept thinking, why did all of us expect the new one to be good? Because it took them so long to make it? Because I think Last Crusade is so bad, and that the first 10 minutes of Last Crusade are the beginning of what went wrong with George Lucas. The beginning of what went wrong with George Lucas really starts with Ewoks, but
that's unfair. That, you know, I need to come through. I need to actually. The Ewoks have gotten a. Listen, I didn't know anyone that talked shit about the Ewoks when that movie came out. No, of course I was 8 when that movie came out.
We all talked shit about it. Don't kid yourself.
It's like, listen, the Ewoks and Wesley Crusher are retroactively dissed by people who get older and realize something's garbage. But look, when we were
Wesley Crusher was dissed at the time. I guarantee you that Wesley Crusher was being dissed at the time.
Yeah, trust your elders, Maddie.
I was an adult watching that show, and I like Will, but
we too.
Wesley Crusher at the time, because it wasn't his fault.
Show and nobody was, dissing it. You know what I mean? It was like amongst other 11-year-olds, we loved Wesley because Wesley.
Oh yeah,
sure.
I was too old to be the target audience for that character.
Me
and
too.
It didn't even occur to me that that there was a target audience for that character. I just kept thinking, why is the kid the smartest guy on the whole ship?
Yep.
Like it just didn't make any sense.
Like hipsters, like retroactively cooling up their childhood. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
No, I never liked the Beatles.
Yeah, I once watched a kid who got into punk rock through Green Day. Like a year, like I remember my girlfriend at the time worked at a record store, and she'd turned this kid onto Green Day. And then like a year later, he was like so hardcore. He was like buying all the old stuff, and. She made some joke. She's like, "Oh, you hear there's new Green Day coming out?" And he was like, "Oh, I never liked Green Day." It was totally like he was dissing the thing that had been his favorite band like a year before because it was, you know, he'd found cooler stuff, and he was
denial. That totally happens with at least with people of my kind of age group where people like get older and cool, and suddenly they're like, "Man, Huey Lewis, come on!" Like, no bullshit. Everybody loved Huey Lewis in 1985.
Yeah. Well, or it's like everybody from my era that I went to high school with will now claim to have gone to like shows that nobody was at all. They were, oh yeah, I was at that Clash show. It's like, no, you weren't. Clash played one show, and you made fun of anyone at school that had a punk rock haircut.
No, but it was one of those things where like, yeah, as I was watching the movie, I was realizing, you know, I'm clearly. I should savage this because it's garbage. It's so tonally out of whack. He's a completely different character in the movie.
I don't even mind the aliens because if I'm willing to believe,
I didn't either.
Like if I'm willing to believe that the Ark of the Covenant can actually work, then why not aliens too?
That's how I feel.
But it was nothing good was kind of said in the movie. I felt like there were no characters in that movie. Like it just was all plot hammering.
This thing is so magnetic. You can throw dust in the air. And the magnetic, like you could throw gunpowder in the air.
Oh, yeah, that was just the most retarded thing ever.
It won't stick to the back of the Jeep. It won't suck your gun to it. It doesn't take your belt. Like, what? It just...
Yeah, that was really lame.
How many CG fucking animals could be in that movie?
Also, back to my original point about Last Crusade, those opening 10 minutes, I think if you view them now, having seen the second Star Wars trilogy appear...
Yep.
Like... That's the beginning of what I like to think of as his sort of continuity sickness, where it's like, what is cool about a character does not need to be explained. Like, nobody needed to know that C-3PO had been constructed by Darth Vader as a child, which also made no sense. But, like, I didn't need to know, like, how Indiana Jones got the scar on his chin or where he got into whips or why he was afraid of snakes. I didn't need to know any of those things, and I certainly didn't need to have them...
That was a pretty exciting Saturday for young Henry Jones.
Yeah, in the course of 10 minutes, he developed every personality trait that you know him for.
I got a scar. Developed my lifelong phobia.
And I got a hat.
Five things in 10 minutes. It was a super Saturday for Indy.
Yeah, and it's like, thank God nothing else ever happened to him. And then you see the TV show, and you're like, well, shit, tons of stuff happened. But the most iconic things that you would know him for all happened in the course of one, 10-minute
line. Oh my god.
What?
Sorry, I'm watching the Cubs game.
Oh. There you go.
I got a really great idea. I got to write it down right now.
The one thing I'll say that I liked about the film and does make me want to maybe see a continuity implant is the comment made about him as an OSS agent during the 40s. And I thought, ooh, that'd be fun to see.
Well, didn't they do a thing that what was it? No, that wasn't the 40s. That was the World War One. There's a World War One story that Darabont did, which I haven't seen, that's like, I think Famke Janssen might even be in that episode of the... Famous actress is in it, too. It's like one of the episodes of...
The Young Indiana.
It may not have ever actually been broadcast, but is going to be released, like... Darabont wrote some of the stuff in the last season of it that was about the sort of older Indy. But, yeah, I don't know. Indiana Jones is just he's such an iconic character that, you just want them all to be good. And,
sure.
There's always an argument that if they had released Temple of Doom first, people would like that better than Raiders. I, I, you I don't know, because I saw Raiders so many times before Temple of Doom came out that, you know, nothing can ever replace Raiders for me as the best DC movie.
I love it. I think Temple of Doom was one of the Temple of Doom is great. I think it's kind of like a misunderstood, it's like the lost classic, you know what I mean? I think
Temple of Doom and Raiders are the ones I like.
I think Temple of Doom is infinitely better than Last Crusade.
They
would go back in and redub another voice over Indy's woman in Temple of Doom.
Cottrell.
Right. Yeah,
that's sort of the
or not Kim Cottrell. What's her name?
Kate Capshaw.
Spielberg. Yeah, Kate Capshaw. If they would go back in and sort of, you know, wherever her voice is, put like a walkie-talkie. You know, like literally though, if they would just get rid of some of her whining, you know, replace it with Luke Skywalker's
whining. I get the gag, but it's sort of like, wow, it's a good gag. The problem is, it's a terrible character to be stuck with in a 2-hour movie.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, also, I hated the. I thought it was a little gratuitous, the dining scene with all the bugs and snakes and stuff like that, and the chilled monkey brains. I'm like,
oh, I like that.
Oh, that disgusted me.
That's one of the cool parts.
Yeah, come on, it was in the temple.
Dude, that's
of
the stuff that's of missing in the new one.
Of course, that's what Kali worshippers are going to eat. They're horrible, awful people.
That's the kind of stuff that's totally missing in the new movie, though. There is no.
Well, you had the killer ants.
In, like, another world.
You had the killer ants, though.
The minute I heard the title, it was the same reaction I had when I heard, like, Phantom Menace was the start. Like, oh, my God, they're so far off the reservation. the thing with him running around the A-bomb site with the weird mannequins, it's just like, this is so not an Indiana Jones movie.
Okay.
In the final episode of the new season of Peep Show, my favorite BBC comedy. They just finished the final episode a couple weeks ago, and on the final episode, it's one of the last couple episodes, one of the characters meets a woman who actually likes him, and he thinks is completely compatible with him, and he likes everything about her, and then they go to this thing, this sort of new agey thing that they're mocking, but then it turns out that she believes in crystal skulls. And it came out like a week after the Indiana Jones movie came out, and I'm like, this can't be a coincidence. But she believes in crystal skulls, and he's so desperate to, like, have a girlfriend that he claims that he believes in crystal skulls, too.
Yeah. Hey, yeah. Have you...
I swear to God, if the Tampa Bay Rays get in the way of the Chicago Cubs, my stepfather-in-law is never going to let me hear the end of it. I'm going to go crazy. I'm going to kill him at Thanksgiving.
Have you guys watched, speaking of British television, The Invisibles, the Anthony Stewart Head new show that's on the BBC?
What? Never even heard of it. No, I'm going to have to go look that up.
It's a new show. It's a new show.
Graham Morrison Invisibles?
No, it has nothing to do, unfortunately, with the Graham Morrison series. But,
but it's the same. It's the same where you said Invisible, not Invincibles.
It is Invisibles, yes, like the title of the Graham Morrison series, yeah. It's him and another guy. They're a pair of safecrackers from the 70s who have retired and are bored with retired life, so decide to get back in the biz.
Oh, wow, that sounds cool.
It's pretty good. I really enjoy it. It's light. It's kind of like Hustle in terms of its tone and not as serious as, like, Spooks
or anything.
That's kind
of cool sometimes, you know. Everything in American TV is so serious. You know, now.
Yeah, I think it's a fun
CSI.
Show. No, it's a fun show. And the other one that I haven't had a chance to watch yet was a miniseries called, it was based on a book about gangsters in the 60s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and B. Claymore and I were talking about the book. He said he read the book, and I can't remember the name of it right now.
British Gangsters in the 60s?
He Only Kills Coppers.
That's what it's called?
Yes, sir.
Oh, wow, I'll have to look that up, too.
So look for that.
Yeah, we watched Ashes to Ashes, which was the sort of Life on Mars sequel, which was really great.
I liked it, too, although a little disappointed that it was as silly as it was and not the mix of drama and comedy that the first... I
thought it was pretty dramatic. Yeah, they did play up a few stuff more than... Yeah, they play up the car a lot more and the sort of, you know, the Gene Genie gags and stuff, but it still had that same tone, kind of. I was a little frustrated that there was no solution. I'm like, okay, is this getting a second season too? Like, I don't even know.
It is.
Oh, okay, good. The outfits were just, I loved how spot on it was because it wasn't the glamorous version of the 80s. It was the real 80s.
Oh, yeah. No,
I was like, oh, yeah, everybody looked awful.
Yeah, 1982 was a great year for music as much as it was a bad year for fashion.
Yeah, it's an awful, awful year for fashion.
What Matt, have you watched Ashes to Ashes?
I haven't. I haven't even gotten through Life on Mars yet. I'm woefully behind on that.
So. You have to watch Life on Mars first, because in the first episode of Ashes to Ashes, they sort of explain the end of Life on Mars, which was the only thing about Life on Mars that I didn't like. I'm like, wow, you can't have every ending. Like, they had three endings to their show, basically, and it was kind of up to the viewer to decide what had happened. And I think they must have gotten enough complaints that in the opening moments of Ashes to Ashes, they kind of explain which one you were supposed to believe.
they sort of, like, people responded to it and got into it over here, sort of right in the middle of the pregnancy and sort of the end of my free time.
And then,
when it came on the BBC over here, Henry was born. It was just like, it's just been a show that I haven't had the time to get to. I know it's not huge, but it's just one of those, I just haven't had a chance to get to it yet, but it's on the list. I'll get to it sooner or later.
That's cool. No, it's a great show. And actually, I finally today saw the tease for the American one.
Oh yeah. I caught
Oh yeah.
Where David E. Kelly, right?
Where the main character looks like he could beat up everybody on the show.
Yeah, he's not John Shim Small, but I still liked, I have to say, I liked it better than I thought I would. I really was prepared to kind of dislike the American version based on
the problem with doing an American version of that is that, like, the American cops were the way British cops were in the early 70s. Like, when American cops were like that, it was more like the early 60s, like the Michael Mann crime story show.
Yep.
Like, post-Miranda rights, you know, like, we have early 70s cops. We have lots of early 70s cop shows.
Right.
And, you know, like, you this know thing that feels the, almost like it's referencing, you know, like Starsky and Hutch as much as it's referencing, you know, like...
You know that's what Milch is doing, right?
What's Milch doing?
Milch's new show is about a guy, a Vietnam vet who comes back, joins the NYPD, goes undercover, sort of infiltrates like leftist and revolutionary kind of in New York City. The thing is though, as post Vietnam, he secretly finds his personal politics aligning with the people he's supposed to be.
That actually happened with people too. He's probably read books by people who did that stuff, because there were undercover guys who totally like tuned in and turned on and dropped out.
Sure.
That sounds like it's that's sort of what his new HBO show is about.
Wow.
Jonathan Ames just sold a show to HBO. It's going to be like Jonathan Ames doing Philip Marlowe sort of stories.
No way.
Yeah.
Wow.
Jonathan Ames is a hilarious weirdo.
Yes, he is. I had the pleasure in New York interviewing him. He has a Vertigo book that he did with Dean Haspiel called The Alcoholic.
Yeah, he's like a comedian.
Oh, okay, yeah.
It's sort of like this P.G. Wodehouse meets Charles Bukowski.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't know how to describe him exactly.
Wow.
Yeah, I heard one of his monologues on The Moth, show. And, he's an interesting guy. I had no idea he sold the show to HBO. That's awesome.
Yeah, I read that today.
Well, HBO's got to get something going. They got nothing right now.
Yeah.
They've got a lot of interesting moves. It might be.
Yeah, they've got stuff in the pipeline, but it's like it's surprising to me that they had nothing ready to go to replace The Wire. Like, I would have thought they had another major drama lined up to start the next Sunday, or the same Sunday that the final. Like, that's how they used to do it. They would have their, whatever show was ending, they'd have the next thing ready to go.
Right.
And I was really shocked. I was like, wow, they don't have their next heavy hitter. They got, they're done with The Sopranos. They're done with The Wire. Deadwood's gone. All my favorite HBO shows. I'm probably the only person in the world who still likes Entourage. But
I still like Entourage.
Yeah, I thought last season of Entourage was the best one, actually.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting as well. Have you guys ever stumbled across, this is a weird, exotic HBO production they make in Brazil. It's about a lawyer named Mandrake. It's called Mandrake. I've seen three episodes. They're all in Spanish, but I'm telling you.
Oh, I caught part of some Spanish lawyer legal thing that they
incredible.
Were showing on HBO one night, really late.
It's incredible, and I really wish they would do. I wish they would just dub or subtitle this show, because it really is a very, very cool show. And I was wondering if you guys had seen it.
They did a really interesting thing. They co-produced a miniseries with the BBC called 5 Days.
Okay.
Forest Whitaker was in that, right?
No, I don't think it was all British people.
It was the terrorist thing.
No, it wasn't. It was
kidnapping or something.
It was about a woman goes missing, and it was actually the 5 days were really interesting because they were each episode happened on a specific day. Like the first day was the day this woman goes missing, and I think the next day was like, you know, the next day after that, and then the next episode was like 2 weeks later, and then the next episode was like a month later, and then the final episode was like 6 months later. And when like and it was interesting, though, because I watched the BBC version of it, and the ending made no sense to me. Like, I was like, wait a second. Like, you had to do so much work to get to figure out what the hell had actually happened. But apparently everybody watching it at HBO thought the same and made them actually reshoot, like, the entire last 10 minutes of it for the HBO version.
Interesting.
So I actually watched the ending again because I'm like, oh, that's what's going on. Like, literally, like, and I prefer subtlety where you actually have to think, but I was like, wait a second, I've watched this whole show, and I don't know who this guy is, who the supposed, you know, murderer is. I'm like, I've seen this guy in one scene so far. Like, how could he be... You know, it really did need to be explained to me. Like, it was one of those ones where you, like, you finish it, and then you go on the Internet, and you're like, what does anyone else think about this? You know, like, you're like, please explain this story to me. Like, and, you know, I'm pretty good at that, usually. The last time I actually had that happen was when I went to the Mark Wahlberg version of Planet of the Apes, where I was, like, I had to go on the Internet afterwards to find out if anyone... could make sense of that ending at all.
Just, I hated that.
You know, was there a single person that seems to have a theory to what that ending actually meant? You know, like, and even that wasn't worth the amount of effort that I put into it. But I was just kind of like, there must be. Would the people who wrote or directed that movie have any clue what that ending is supposed to mean?
That was a bad Gold Key Twilight Zone comic book ending.
Oh,
where you're just like, ah.
Yeah. I was like,
that
wait.
Movie was garbage. That movie
Abe
was garbage.
Lincoln is a monkey.
Such a bummer. That whole movie was such a bummer.
Yes, it was.
Yeah, Tim Burton, man. Tim Burton hasn't made a good movie since Beetlejuice. I'm going to say it right now.
Ed Wood.
Okay, Ed Wood.
I loved Ed Wood.
That doesn't count.
I did love Ed Wood.
Ed Wood is such a good movie that it doesn't even seem like Tim Burton made it.
I heard Sweeney Todd was terrific. Again,
I keep hearing that, too. I stayed away from
it. My neighbor's 9-year-old daughter, like, rented it. She's like, this looks good. Apparently not appropriate for a 9-year-old girl.
Go figure.
Wildly inappropriate for children.
Well, we learned something today. I think that's
good. The demon barber. Who would have known?
Yeah, go figure.
We thought they meant that.
Slash cannibal.
Maybe it's like a devil like hot stuff.
Yeah. We thought they meant like Jack Kirby's demon where he's like a good guy.
There'll be no sloppy joes in this house for a long time.
Oh. Ew.
Yeah, when I went down to L.A., Mark Andreyko picked me up to go hang out, and he was listening to the Sweeney Todd soundtrack in his car, and he had seen the movie like multiple times.
Wow!
But Mark is a huge musical guy, though. Mark will actually go see like a good musical like on stage. So I took that as a sign that, and you know, Mark knows my feelings about Tim Burton, and Mark seemed to think it was a really great movie, so he urged me to see it, and I refused.
Jesus, did you guys see State of Play? The BBC.
Oh yeah, State of Play is great. I'm curious to see how they'll remake it.
Me too.
It could easily work over here.
Yeah, but I really did love it as a British story, and I'm always nervous.
Who's directing the?
They're doing it over here, right?
Yeah, they're doing it. Russell Crowe took Brad Pitt's place.
Oh my God, have you seen the trailer for Burn After Reading?
No.
The new Coen Brothers flick?
No.
Oh, no.
Brad Pitt, George Clooney, John Malkovich. Brad Pitt plays like a personal trainer. John Malkovich is a spy who leaves some sort of classified...
Oh, yeah, yeah, I read about this.
No, I haven't.
Oh, my God, the trailer looks fantastic.
Cool. When's that coming out? Christmas or...?
Fall, I think.
Okay.
Yeah. They're already started working on their next movie after that, too.
Wow.
They're back.
Nice. I'll take them.
No kidding.
If I were the Coen Brothers, I would make a movie every year. Like, why not be like Woody Allen? Like, strike while the iron's hot, you know?
Sure.
They're never going to be bigger than they are now after, I guess they were this big after Fargo, too.
Well, you know, but it's a sort of Soderbergh thing. Go out, go until your batteries are out of juice. You know what I mean? I mean, apparently the story going around now is Soderbergh is so deep into shooting The Informant that he's just letting the Che Guevara movie sit. And he'll get back to it when he's done shooting The Informant. Like, he knows he needs to trim the Che Guevara stuff after Khan.
He's not. Wow.
He's just sitting. He's like, fine, it's fine. I'm shooting another movie right now. So he's going to shoot it, and then he'll come back to it where he's when he's got kind of the brain space to deal with it, which is like, I really admire the shit out of that. That's an admirable work ethic.
I like
learned that on the set of Aaron Brockovich.
Hey, look, I mean, you can't argue with that string. You know what I mean? Like that kind
no,
of.
No, that year when he was nominated against himself.
Yeah.
That's right. Jesus. Well, boys, as always. We're reaching the 2-hour mark, so I don't want to. I know, and that's usually the answer I get from Brevet. Oh shit, 2 hours! Yeah. Damn it! No, I know.
That's okay. I finished the script today. I felt really good about myself today. From about 4 o'clock on, I was like, I finished the script.
For which book?
I got about 6 pages.
I finished the cap script today, which I was stuck on last week, and then I finally plowed through, and then we ended up having to do a bunch of stuff this weekend instead of write, and I was like, damn it.
And Maddie, what's in the typewriter for you?
Thor: Secret Invasion 2 is going to get wrapped up tonight.
Excellent. Quickly, any thoughts on, you know, are you guys at all involved with the big events like Secret Invasion? Okay, Matt's doing Thor. What else?
You're not doing
anything to do with any of that stuff.
Okay.
I gave Brian permission to use Captain America.
Right.
I laughingly say I gave Brian permission. No, I because of Daredevil doesn't fit into stuff like that. I mean, what was I going to do, have Karen Page show up and be a Skrull? Now that I say it out loud, of course, yes, I should have done
Idiot.
That. But,
yeah, Edward,
you know,
the
and
hell,
Cap
dude,
is in the midst of this
money in the bank sitting by the side of the road.
Yeah, I know. but, you know, the American dollar's worth so little, it doesn't really matter.
That's a good point.
Cap, I'm involved in
right.
like, a huge thing, and, you know, we just did our big X-Men crossover and moved them to San Francisco. I think they're doing an X-Men tie-in, but, you know, I am of the mind that there should be as few tie-ins as there needs to be.
And the Mike Carey's doing the X-Men thing. It's incredible.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure it will be.
Oh, yeah, him and Dan. Yeah,
it's
him
like
and Dan
a self-contained. It's a Nightcrawler thing, right?
Beast.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I like
that. It's about the X-Men, but I bet it's specifically McCoy comes up with something interesting. It's really
oh.
cool.
Okay. Very.
McCoy reinvents the Hot Pocket.
Oh, man. Is there anything?
Reinvents the Hot Pocket. They're calling it the Warm Pocket.
If I'm known for anything on my X-Men run, let me be the man known for making the Beast have to deal with Hot Pockets. which I'm not kidding. I totally do.
Well, I think Hot Pocket should be like you snap one side of it and it heats up.
Like a glow stick?
Oh. Yeah, like a glow stick. Like it heats itself, like the bag. Each side of the bag until it makes a snap noise, and then you sit the bag down for like a minute, and then the Hot Pocket becomes, you know, hot.
Yeah, there's no health issues with that. What kind of power source?
I'm talking future tech.
Oh, my God.
There's tiny microscopic organisms that get really hot all over it.
Nano pockets.
Nano. Yeah, it's nano cooking.
Man, call Pillsbury. I think you got something.
These nano pepperonis are nano delicious.
Yeah, it's like the opposite of the end of Ghostbusters. It's the nanotech Pillsbury Doughboy.
Don't think about delicious flavor.
There's a billion of them, and he's tiny. But that was my million-dollar idea was the Hot Pocket that heats itself, and then my other million-dollar idea.
Which, a million-dollar idea. I mean, it's a million-dollar idea if it's something that could be executed. That's like science fiction. That's like, oh, my million-dollar idea was a bank that teleports money into your pants whenever you're broke. Like,
yeah, but I think conceivably they could make a rations packet that would heat up the food.
You think so?
They probably have stuff like that for astronauts.
I was going to say, if they could put a man in space, they could certainly do this.
Yeah. My other idea was sound effects in emails.
What was your other idea for quickly?
Sound effects in emails, like emoticons that have noises. Like you have to click the thing and it would be like a rim shot or
you know, I already keep the speaker on my computer turned off because fucking sound files bugged in with like pop-up menus and stuff like that. Like,
oh, yeah.
Whoop. Yeah, I do that too.
Congratulations. Yeah. You've been selected to
learn. Oh, man. That one. Hey, you did a really good, yeah. Silver Bullet Comics. I just want to say, Silver Bullet Comics. Congratulations, you've been selected to win a new iPod.
Congratulations, I'm not going to your site anymore.
They're known as Comics Bulletin now, and they love you.
Well, the boys at Newsarama appreciate that. That's good. Honestly, that's good. Well, Matt, quickly, can you say anything about Secret Asian Thor? Invasion? Secret Asian Thor.
Secret Asian Thor.
Yeah, Secret Asian Thor.
Asian
Exactly.
The Skrulls are coming. They send a very unique warning to Asgard that sets the tone and timbre of their plans for the Asgardians.
They arrive at Asgard and they're like, dude, you know you're like 10 feet off the ground?
Exactly. And Thor realizes that if they come for Asgard, then they're going to come for Broxton too. That Asgard's proximity to Broxton and Thor's desire to really re-engage with mankind has in fact made mankind a target, and that's a fight that they haven't asked for. So it becomes about Asgard fighting this war on two fronts between defending Asgard and defending Broxton. And concurrent to this, the one pregnant woman in Broxton goes into labor, and so Don Blake has to stay with her.
Oh, wow.
And she gives birth to 10 Skrulls.
So the thing is the Skrulls are coming, and the general can't get on the battlefield because he needs to be with man, and that's ultimately... So it's this kind of...
cool.
And then 9 kinds of hell breaks loose, and I designed...
If only he had a nurse that had become a doctor...
Tell you what, she's
is Jane Foster in this thing?
I was going to say, where's Jane?
JMS is doing stuff with her.
Oh, is he? Okay.
She's in the main book.
I thought I was the last person to actually use her as a character when I used her in that issue of the All Nomad issue of Captain America.
There's a Jane issue coming. We get to kind of in Thor very soon.
You know, we should do like a First Wives Club, one shot thing for all the Marvel, like the original girlfriends who are now all sort of like the cast off girls.
Yeah, I always thought that
like Jane Foster,
Liz Shaw,
and Pepper Potts, and you know all the girls that they were originally hooked up with. You know, I guess Sharon Carter is now back because I took over the book, but you know. The various, you know, I guess Gwen Stacy's clone could be there.
Or you could have Liz Shaw.
Who's that?
Wasn't it Liz Shaw? Wasn't that the original girlfriend?
No, you're thinking of Betty
Brant.
Betty, I thought Liz was a high school girl.
Allen? No.
Liz Allen, thank you. Thompson's That's who I meant, girlfriend. Liz Allen. Okay.
No, Liz, I don't think, Liz had like a minor flirtation with Peter at some point pre-MJ, but Betty Brant was his first. Like real girlfriend,
Betty girl, yeah.
May I say too, I don't like the way Marvel decided that. Well, Betty was too old for Peter, and immediately said like that's the one retcon of Brand New Day that I found silly, that they decided Betty was too old for Peter and it wasn't an age appropriate relationship. And I'm like, why couldn't Betty be a high school girl that needed to work as opposed to go to college and
Wait,
make it an age appropriate?
That was part of Brand New Day. They got rid of the Betty Brant relationship.
I think they've made it more friendly as opposed to truly that they were dating. That I thought
well,
I
they've
that.
Been friends, like in the. I mean, they hadn't actually acted like there was anything between them for you know, since the early '70s, really. Like she was helping him get an apartment, like in the early '70s too.
Okay.
I think that's how he met Glory Grant.
Who became
J. Jonah Jameson's next secretary.
No, I meant Betty. I thought I had read that. Maybe I read it wrong.
Oh yeah, no, I don't know. I know what you're saying. Well, I think just bringing her back into the book at all, they sort of have to. But, yeah, I, you know, it never occurred to me reading those as a kid that she wasn't the same age as him. I thought maybe she was maybe, you know, a tiny bit older. But you also never think of Peter Parker as being 15.
Yeah. That's true.
Until reading Ultimate Spider-Man, he doesn't look 15 ever.
That's true.
You know, if he did, like, you know, he was a really terrifying-looking 15-year-old. A very gawky kid.
Steve Ditko, everybody was terrifying.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, they always look very manic.
Yeah, Gwen Stacy does not look cute in the like new Steve Ditko appearances. She's close for a Ditko girl, but Ditko girls were not really hot.
No.
Clea, the Doctor Strange's girl, was like the hottest Steve Ditko girl probably.
And even then, it was like schizophrenic girl hot. It was sort of like, oh, you're a car crash hot. It was like, oh, what's that? You're a suicide girl, kind of hot. You know what I mean?
Yeah, exactly.
You got issues. You're trouble.
You guys are
Let
killing
me.
Me.
Fix you. Why you steal all my money? Why your ex-boyfriend to live in our apartment?
Jesus.
Yeah,
that's Clea.
Well, boys, I'm happy to stop here and say thank you because, as always, it's great to talk to both of you. It was fun to talk to you at the same time.
I'm glad we got to talk about comics a little.
Yeah, well, you know, I think we did a good job.
I read comics.
We covered
Nerd.
Comics, and we made our nice digressions into the fun pop culture stuff. But honestly, good luck with X-Men. I really enjoyed your guys' collaboration on Iron Fist, and look forward to the back and forth that we're going to see in X-Men. And
500 really looks terrific. It looks like a fucking X-Men movie. It's just incredible.
It's really, and we got to do all the sort of, you know, the 500 issue celebration stuff. In a way that I think is different than what everyone would expect necessarily, or at least I hope is different. Like we hit the same kind of beat, but we do it almost in a sort of, you know, we're acknowledging it, you know, almost in the text actually, as opposed to the subtext.
Okay.
Which, take that, Grant Morrison. Our text acknowledged itself.
Wow.
Yeah. Someone asked me, they're like, what's the other part that's, like, not the subtext? Like, if you want to have something in the story that's not, you know, like, the subtext is this, and then what's the other part? I'm like, that's just the text.
That was one of my favorite lines in art school was there was a guy who, anytime anybody asked him, well, what's this all about? What's that all about? It's subtext. And we had to explain to him, like, if it's there on screen, it's not subtext. Like, if I'm watching it, it's not subtext. It's subtext. Don't worry about it. It's subtext. I'm pretty sure it's text.
Quickly, con appearances this summer, guys?
I am going to Heroes Con in 4 hours.
Okay,
oh
fantastic. Oh, Jesus,
I was
man.
Going to Heroes Con, but our dog got injured, and so we've had to stay home and take care of our dog and keep a really close eye on him. But the plan currently is to be at San Diego.
You sent stuff for Heroes Con, right?
I forgot to do that.
There's still time. You can still do it.
Oh, yeah, it's still only. I could overnight a box to you, right?
What's
tomorrow,
totally.
Thursday?
Huh?
Tomorrow's Wednesday.
Tomorrow's Wednesday. Oh, I could still get stuff out to you.
Yeah, totally.
I have that address. I'll try to do that.
Make sure you do, because they announced it already that it was happening.
Did they?
In Dusty's email, yeah. I told Dusty that you were going to send along a box of apology stuff.
Oh, my God. Okay, well, I better do that. I'll be getting that done tomorrow.
Excellent. We'll look for Matt then at Heroes, and look for Ed at San Diego. Matt, will you be at San Diego or no?
I will be at San Diego as well, and then I'm doing the Toronto Super Jam that I'm so excited. Buzz Aldrin and Henry Winkler and Chip Zdarsky, three of my favorite people in the world, are doing that show. So
wow.
I'm very excited.
That.
I'd like to see a future team-up book, Fraction of the Fonz and Buzz Aldrin and Chip Zdarsky. I think that'd be great.
It was like roommates. That would be great.
Living next door to John Huston and Orson Welles.
What was that movie, Family Business, with Marlon Brando, Dustin Hoffman, and Matthew Broderick?
It was Sean Connery.
The Matthew Broderick of the scenario.
It'd be Buzz Aldrin, Henry Winkler, and Chip Zdarsky. Three generations of con men living together in a station wagon. On a beach, and they never leave.
That's how you pronounce his last name. I always thought it was Zdarsky.
Maybe I don't know. I'm embarrassed.
I've never heard it said out loud though.
Neither have I.
Chip,
knowing Chip, it's probably a name he made up that's impossible to actually pronounce properly.
Yeah, his real last name is Jenkins. Chip Jenkins. You mean something?
Chip Jenkins. It's not even Chip. It's Chet.
Chet Jenkins.
Chet Jenkins.
I like that.
But no one wants to be known as Chet, except for Chester Brown.
Does he really?
Did you hear Chester Brown and Dave Sim had a falling out?
No.
I don't even know what that means. I didn't know they had a falling in.
Yeah, no, they've been friends. Yeah, it's there's a very public. You can read the faxed correspondence back and forth, because that's apparently Dave Sim doesn't do email, but he will do faxing, and he's requiring people, anyone who wants to maintain contact with him, to sign a statement that says that they don't believe that he is a misogynist. And Chester said that under the traditional, you know, dictionary definition, he doesn't think that he's a misogynist, but under the understood definition that if you think women are mentally inferior to men, then you're a misogynist, which isn't what the dictionary definition of a misogynist is, which is someone who hates women. He's like, I don't think you hate women, but I think you think men are superior to women, you know, and... So it's very interesting. You can track it down on the internet. It's like, you know, one of those things where you've got 10 minutes to burn and you're looking for something really controversial on the internet. It comes close. It's not really that controversial, but It's been kind of interesting
it's
to see Dave Sims interact.
A friendship ends, it's a bummer.
Yeah. It does feel kind of like that, actually. It was kind of like, really? Like, they'd been collaborating for years on, like, an open-ended comic that they've been working on that they've published bits and pieces of. So, and, you know, I mean, they're both amazing cartoonists, but they're both really, you know, really interesting, completely, you know, just
unique.
Different kind of people.
Yeah.
Like, they're both definitely, like, this is who I am, and I'm not changing for you, you know, like... So it's kind of interesting to see two people like that who, you know, neither of them would possibly back down against anyone else over like any kind of viewpoint. So it was just interesting to see the debate kind of, you know, framed. So
did
so
you
like
read,
that reminded me of.
Did you pick up Glamour Puss or?
I did.
Is Glamour Puss out?
The first issue came out.
Oh man, I looked at the first issue at the store. It looks amazing. But I've heard from a few people that it's slow going on the reading, but it really reads like someone's thesis about Alex Raymond. But I'm such a fan of Alex Raymond that I just kind of feel like I think I might actually be the target audience for this comic.
Guys, may I mention the Alex Raymond biography that's out there?
Oh, really?
Very well.
When did this come out?
Actually, he's a downstate Illinois writer. And
Tom Roberts, Alex Raymond, His Life and Art.
Thank you, attaboy, Matty. Yes.
That's always... They just someone on the Chicago Cubs, like, held up a sign that said all that.
Weirdly enough.
Don Zimmerich.
Bottom of the ninth inning or top of the ninth.
Then they flipped it back around. He's like, John, 23, 42.
Yeah, it's supposed to be fantastic. Friends of mine who have already read it love it. And he's going to be at the Chicago, the Wizard Chicago convention. I'm assuming he's going to San Diego. I'm not sure, but I hear great things about this book, and I intend to have him on a Word Balloon episode. And I'm glad Alex
added to my wish list.
I wonder how much he got into the death of Alex Raymond stuff, because I'm really fascinated by that. Because
what about his adventures drawing hardcore pornography? Do you know anything about? Did he cover that? The Tijuana Bible Years?
I don't know.
Did he actually have those?
No, but it's a rumor I'm working on starting. For
I like
oh,
it.
Oh, wow. Well, I have a good one for you. I gave a friend of mine, a couple weeks ago, we went to a friend's birthday, and I gave him this Toshin book of old, like, 40s and 50s era bondage porn comics.
Sweet.
That Toshin just did this reprint of, and the art is amazing. It's called, like, Dominating Wives or something like that. But Tom Pyre was at this birthday party, and he was flipping through the book, and he's like, hey, you know, I recognize this stuff. I think this is the guy that Steve Ditko used to share an office with.
Oh, yeah, it's Eric. I've seen those pages. Ditko did the lightweight bondage stuff. Eric.
Yeah, Ditko actually drew on some of the art. Like, helped the guy finish some of it, apparently.
Eric Staten?
Yeah, that's it, exactly.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think that's the name, actually. It's something like that. It reminded me of Joe Staten.
Somebody, but yeah, Ditko, it's clearly...
They were studio mates, and apparently there's panels where you can see that they're clearly inked by Ditko.
But suddenly this dominatrix is wearing, like, webbed gloves and has, like, the crazy Ditko fingers, and it's like, wait, what?
What's that they were doing with that whip? Wait a minute.
Yeah, that's where the bent finger thing came from. One in the pink, one in the stink.
Did you just start a rumor, Ed, that Steve Ditko invented the shocker? Because that is amazing. That is amazing.
Steve Ditko invented the shocker.
Outstanding.
His version only had one in the stink and one in the pink. Wow. I think it was Oeming who added the extra one for the stink.
Wow.
Or was it for the pink? I can't remember.
Oh, that's awesome.
If you do two and two, that's the Spocker.
The Spocker. Oh, that's gross.
I like it.
Yeah, all right, we got to end this conversation.
Yes, gentlemen, thank you. This is why I have you guys on, for that kind of comment. Thank you, truly.
For that highbrow, Steve.
Yeah.
Material.
It's worthless for anyone who wants to actually learn anything about our work. But, hey, if you want to learn about the Spocker or the Shocker.
It's Word Balloon After Dark. That's where you guys come. I appreciate it.
You should get a fantastic.
Word Balloon After Dark.
John, a pleasure as always, sir. Ed, a delight as always. And I'm going to go to the bathroom, finish the Thor script, and sleep for 20 minutes, and go to Charlotte.
All right, yeah, good
fun.
Luck. And thank you, Ed, and we'll talk to both of you soon.
Okay, cool. Bye.
I'm telling you, it's always good to talk to those guys. Ed Brubaker, Matt Fraction. It was a pleasure, and I hope to do it again very soon. Enjoy their books. Uncanny X-Men 500 comes out later this month. Of course, Fraction continues with The Invisible Iron Man. He's also co-writing Punisher War Journal with Rick Remender. As for Ed Brubaker, you've got Captain America, Daredevil, and of course his great icon book, Criminal. That'll do it for this edition of Word Balloon. Thanks again for listening. This is John Suntress. You can find Word Balloon all over the internet. Make sure you check out our website, wordballoon.com. Of course, we're at newsarama.com as well. And we're at iTunes, at Podcast Alley, Podcast Pickle. You can come to our MySpace page, myspace.com/wordballoon. Our ComicSpace page, comicspace.com/wordballoon. And if you have any questions or comments regarding the show, I can always be reached via email, john@wordballoon.com. Stick around next week. More fun coming. We're going to have more floor interviews from Wizard Chicago, including a look at Batman Gotham Knight, the DVD. We talk with a lot of the people behind that project. Some good roundtable discussions, and lots of big guests coming up along the way throughout the month of July. Thanks for listening. Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions, copyright 2008.